Welcome to the Age Stage. In this, our second episode for 2017, my name's Vicky Barber, and with me on the controls is Brody Guzay. Hello, Brody.
How are you?
I'm good. How are you this week?
Oh, look, vertical.
As I always say, I always like coming into the studio and you're vertical.
And I'm very pleased that this week has not going to be as hot as it has been.
Oh, okay. You're liking the little bit of a chill off, are you?
Well, I'm not a hot weather person.
Oh, aren't you?
No. Right. Are you?
I grew up in Queensland, so I'm used to it being a little bit hot and sweaty, and it reminds me of home.
I would have died in that heat this week. That those
Queensland has been tough. No. Speaking to family, it's been tough. So, yes, we're all thankful that it's a little bit cooler down here.
Well, although, interestingly enough, at the men's shed, we have got a guy who takes an awful long time to say something very basic. But he's been doing weather forecasting as his thing, his shtick.
Like his hobby?
Yes. He's a bit of a gardener. And he's been doing that for 60 years or something. And he actually predicted that big high.
Yes.
3 weeks ago, he said that's coming.
Oh, really?
Yep, absolutely he did. He said, you wait, this is going to come down from there, that'll come down from there, and that's going to block this out, and it's going to be very, very hot.
That's really interesting. So he's obviously been tracking it for so long that he knows what's going to happen.
Knows all the ins and outs. And he says it's going to be a cold winter.
Oh, right. Well, that's good if I want to go skiing.
Well, yes. But absolutely nothing to do with winter.
No. Our show today.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So today we have Kim with us from the Retirement Village Alliance. So Kim is stepping in for Peter and Tom and Stuart, who obviously just can't make it with us today. And Kim will be talking to us about making your home age safe. So as you're getting older and making sure that the home is set up for you to utilise easier. And we'll also be speaking to an architect, Brendan Hoban.
Yep.
And he apparently did the renovations here.
He did.
On our studio and building. But he also works with the broader council, Shire.
Yep.
In making sure buildings and homes are appropriate for the elderly as well. And then we'll have, in our last segment, carrying on from our medical story of last week, we'll be talking to Dr. Mark Shulman, and he's undertaking a study into predicting the outcomes, whether they be good or bad, post-surgery.
It'll be interesting.
It will be interesting discussions today, Brody.
So we've got a bit of DIY.
It's a
sort of men's shed, sort of Bunnings sort of day.
It is.
Well, I'm looking forward to hearing from Kim because she's from a village point of view. And I suppose, actually, the two stories, because we've got one that's about doing your stuff at your own home. And the other is actually about the architectural for retirement villages.
Yes, if you're looking to move into that style of living.
Brilliant.
So let's bring Kim on.
Well, we know that we have her walk-in music or their walk-in music. So
we do.
We'll just quietly slip into that and then she will magically appear in a sort of puff of audio smoke.
Welcome, Kim Ashcroft. How are you today, Kim?
Fabulous. Thank you. It's lovely to be back.
Oh, good to have you back. Always nice to have you here.
You're looking rather lonely just sitting there.
I am, yes. Just me today. The boys are all busy.
Well, so they say.
So they say.
They've just sent the specialist in.
They have.
give us a rundown on what they're all up to.
Stuart's on holidays.
Right.
Peter Nelson's just come back from holidays.
Right.
And Tom has a prior appointment.
Right.
So, yes, now, all very busy.
We thought that Stuart was unwell.
Stuart is very well.
Oh, he's brilliant.
Enjoying leave. He takes leave so rarely, people do think he's unwell when he takes holidays. Right.
Anyone know what I'm going to do with this reef? I ordered from the Age Stage.
Very appropriate.
Send it
anyway. If you put your name on the end, Brody, he won't be
just
surprised. Won't be surprised. So, Kim, you're here to talk to us today about retirement village units or homes, et cetera, and how they are built appropriate for those in the older stages of life and what sort of aspects to look out for or that you imply or impart there for
probably them. If we start from the very start when you go into your home, whether it be in a village or your own home in the community, how do you get there? Is it flat? Because retirement villages don't build steps.
Right.
And we make sure our paths are actually the appropriate gradient for older people, which is 1 in 14, which means over 14 metres you only rise 1, which is a very slow, gentle, steep slow, gentle incline.
Yep.
And that's for ease of walking. That's for ease of walking. As if you had a, were in a scooter, I don't know.
Yes, if you're in a scooter or someone's pushing you in a wheelchair, or you have your own little wheelie walker that you often see people walking with, if the incline is very steep.
What did you call it?
A wheelie walker.
A wheelie. I thought it was Willy.
No. A wheelie walker.
Right.
My wheelie doesn't need one. Yes.
Sorry. And Brody. When you're pushing those up steep inclines, often it's very difficult, and if you're sitting something on the little seat on it, it falls off.
Oh, yes, of course.
So it's important to have an easy way to actually get into a unit or into your home.
And I suppose if you're also wanting just to go to your neighbour or across to the dining room or
Absolutely.
Whatever as well.
And not just the front door, it's also looking at the back door or the laundry door. Because one of the things that people don't often consider as they get older is, how do you hang your washing out? Because most people have steps from their laundry door. So, again, it's a matter of retirement villages don't have steps. We have flat ways of getting out through your laundry to go and hang your laundry out on the washing line and a path around to the washing line.
Right.
Because when you, again, when you get older, if you're walking across the grass to get to the washing line, which most of us would do in our own homes, it's an uneven surface. It's more you're more likely to fall, which is what age-safe housing tries to avoid, is trip hazards and things that can make you fall over.
Preventing the fall, which can therefore injure you and, and have repercussions,
and getting from,
of course.
I'm a nurse, and we often talk about there's a point where you fall over and then you start to have a fall. And it's this little invisible line that people sort of cross over. And when you start to have a fall, it sort of insinuates that you are getting a bit older and a bit frailer, and it's a bit more dangerous for you to move around outside or on steps or those sorts of things.
Right.
So being on a flatter surface is much more important the older that you get.
Right, right. And what other aspects, say, once you're inside the home then?
Once you're inside the home, it's important that things are at the right levels for you and the right fittings. So bathroom taps, you need to be able to grip them. So the old cross taps that used to be round, or the lever taps, much better than the new modern square things or round things that might look fabulous but are just not suitable for someone who's older, who have has arthritis
and
can't
may not
actually
be able
turn
to
them.
Put their hand on it appropriately.
Well, lever taps give that nice sort of sterile hospital functional look, don't they?
Yeah, the flick master.
Yeah.
But again, that's easy if you, you know, unfortunately are crippled, so to speak, and your hands with arthritis, that's much easier for you to then utilise.
Much easier. Yes. And again, it's not just the bathroom taps, it's the kitchen taps and the laundry taps as well that need to be of a fitting that you can use. If you think about just general safety tips around the house, so what's safe, the furniture needs to be arranged in such a way that there's enough space to move it, because we all love clutter and adding things into the home. But if there's not enough space to walk around with your walker so the wheels won't get caught on the chair legs, that can be quite dangerous as well. So you need to make sure there's lots of space, a lot more space than you probably ordinarily would have had maybe 20 years prior. So instead of having, you know, the coffee table in the middle of the lounge room, do you really need the coffee table, or is it better to have it next to the table, next to the chair that you're sitting in, and having lots of space in front of the couch so you can get to the couch with your walker in a safe way?
So it's more of a minimalist styling,
yes,
I suppose.
It
is what you're implying as well.
It's that open plan type styling, which is what retirement villages do. When we're actually designing units, we will work out where people should put their furniture and how much space there's going to be around that, and make sure that there's power points to have lamps on the tables next to the chairs, so that encourages people to actually not put a coffee table in the middle of the room, put it next to the lounge chair.
So would you put your electrical power point, I was trying to think of the term, up higher as well in general? Usually they're about 300 off the floor, but when you're older, you don't really want to be bending down so far. Do you do that as well?
We do a mix. Tom in his village actually offers they'll do 500 high ones right through. We offer a mix where behind the television, it doesn't matter if it's 300 because that's where the television's going to sit, but beside the beds and some other places where you do want to access
where
the point, we'll make it higher.
A bit more regularly.
In the bathrooms, again, you put the power point at the place where it's going to be nice and convenient for someone to plug a shaver into. But that's all restricted by having them within so many centimetres.
You have to have
centimetres
so far
of the water
from
source
the water
and all
source,
those things.
Yes.
Yes, but the other thing is, though, just working on PowerPoints, is that when people have got little manual dexterity, that the actual plugs themselves and the bits that the charging is and all that, they're very close together. They really need to have a sort of senior...
a little bit larger, wider, yes, a bit of a space so between them.
The whole hand can get in and remove those sorts of bits and pieces.
Oh, I don't know if they do that.
Well,
I don't know either, but
I think they should be invented.
Right. We might be able to ask the architect.
The age stage coming in. New wall panel there that we've just developed. There we go. No, but those sorts of things are important. And yes. I know that...
you can get bigger wall switches. Yes. So yes, they can be much bigger. But I haven't seen the bigger power points, but that's absolutely correct. It's very difficult.
Particularly with the number of charger-type bits and pieces that you have these days for things like phones and pads and, toothbrushes and all the rest of it. And I think that's also one of the dangers is that you can end up with electrical bits shunting out power into various bits of equipment all over the place.
You can.
And that means that you can forget about something that's on charge and been sitting there for 3
yes,
months.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah. In one of the things that villagers do very well is put extra power points in these days, because we do try and discourage people running power cords and running things off the power boards.
Yep. Right.
Because they're trip hazards for people as well as fire hazards, particularly some of the cheaper boards that you can, you pick them up in the $2 shop, but you're not quite actually sure of the safety behind them.
That's true.
Those power cords.
You would all have those breakers, though.
Yes.
Wouldn't they? They would be an automatic requirement, wouldn't they?
It is, absolutely. Yep. The safety switches. Yep. One thing that I can talk from experience, we had a small fire in the village last year, where a resident had a 20-year-old electric blanket on their bed.
Oh, goodness.
That caught fire when they got up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. And thankfully the resident was okay. She got out, but her unit was gutted.
Right.
And that's something that we very strongly encourage in our village, that if your electric blanket's more than 18 months old, throw it out and buy a new one.
Gosh.
That particularly the very old ones can be really dangerous. And when you get some of that old bed linen that is so flammable...
Do you have, just as part of your info entertainment for the villagers, do you, on your news sheets and all the rest of it, do you say that it's electric checking month or those sorts of things where you have people to check their...
That varies from village to village. Yeah. We have a service where people can actually have their electrical appliances safety checked.
Oh,
it costs $5 an appliance, and they can get it checked, because we have to, as a registered aged care provider, do that for all the people in our nursing homes.
So they're all tagged.
So all of our office equipment and our nursing home equipment's tagged, but in the independent units, we offer the same service if they'd like that.
And so someone goes through and checks it.
Someone goes
tags.
Through, checks it, tags it. And we encourage residents when we're there to attend safety, maintenance, ordinary things like that. If we see a kettle looking a bit old or a toaster looking a bit old, perhaps it's time to replace it.
Mm. And you'll make that comment.
Yeah,
sort of
we do.
One of your staff members.
And then depending on how frail a resident is, sometimes we take it away and give it to their family and say, you probably really need to be having a look at this. And that's one of the benefits of villages, because there's lots of sets of eyes all helping to, keep people in their homes for longer. And
now, ingress and egress and doors, sliding doors and those sorts of things to allow for wheelchairs and what have you. Are sliding doors a major option for units? Because they should be easier. They're
certainly very common on the outside of units. But inside units, because when you slide a door into the cavity that it goes in, the door sits out about 15 centimetres, which actually reduces the entry space. So you need to have oversized sliding doors.
Yes.
But once you start getting into oversized doors, they become custom made and expensive and quite heavy.
Right.
So, and once they're heavy, they're a bit harder for the frailer older people to slide. So it's a real balance. So if you can avoid having a door, by all means avoid the door, have open hallways.
Yes.
And then in bathrooms, make sure that they're really good sliding fittings if you're going to use them. But we do make sure that they're oversized doors just in any parts of the internal of the unit, so that people can move around with wheelchairs, wheelie walkers. And they have the turning circle. If they're holding their wheelie walker, they can actually turn with it in their hands.
So what is the wider door frame or the wider door width then that you would have within your
In our new units, we have between 820 and 920 wide doors. So they are quite wide. And there's lots of suggestions about how to make a home disabled friendly, and they use very wide doors, very big turning circles. But over the years, we've found with older people, it's very, very rare to have a resident in an independent unit who's in a wheelchair 24/7.
Right.
Because generally they don't have the upper body strength to actually move themselves around in the unit. Mm. And by that stage, they move into care anyway. So there's a real balance between something that's completely disabled compliant and something that's just suitable for an older person that's right. still comfortable and feels homely and not institutionalised.
Right. So what would you do with a bathroom, for example?
The bathrooms, we have oversized showers. If we can avoid to have a door on the shower or a door that's not actually part of the frame, we will. That way the door can come off.
Right.
Extra bench space so that things can be laid out on the bench instead of people bending over into cupboards. Lots of space to have a chair in the bathroom so that when someone gets out of the shower, they can actually sit down and dry their feet. And again, space in the shower to actually put a shower chair in there so they can sit down.
Well, that's very modern in the sense that there's now... They've got the tiled floor that virtually just slopes away to the grid, and then a piece of glass, and that's it.
Yeah.
So it's architecturally it's been getting better.
Mm. Yes, or sexier, it has.
And now it just makes it more practical, really.
It does.
Grab handles, of course, would be an issue.
Grab handles, extra towel rails, a shower that is hands free as well as that can hook up. So then you can sort of, if you're having assistance to stay at home and someone from the community care department's coming to shower you, they can get in and actually move the shower around and keep warm water on
you. It's got to be sort of bigger than 900 wide, then, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it does. Although you can have a 900 by 900 shower that's suitable. It all depends on the shower screen.
Yeah.
So provided.
It wouldn't have a door, though.
Yeah, you don't have the door, or you have a door that opens really, really wide and can let everything else in.
Right.
Yeah, but that...
What about heating?
Heating's a challenge. We have reverse cycle air conditioning at the village, and we find that works well. Some of our age group are so used to having a blow heater and the little radiator heaters that we really discourage because they're very dangerous. People can get... very dry, burnt skin very easily on those. They can get knocked over and have a fire hazard. So we do encourage the split systems at the village, and that's what most villages do these days, the reverse cycle split systems.
Well, I think from an economy point of view, I believe dual cycle air conditioning heating is actually the cheapest form of
heating,
of
is heating. It?
Yeah, it is. It's I don't know why, but I think it falls into that category. We'll ask the architect ask Brendan when he comes in and see what that's about. So we've heated the place, we've lit the place, we've got access to the place. Are there any things about things like airing cupboards and places inside where people can dry their smalls without using tumble dryers and things? Because it's often that you get to that stage where you don't need the big home size appliances. Yeah. You only really need things that are almost sort of just to do your
smaller.
Knickers. Yeah. Do they have laundries that are like that, or
the laundries vary? There is space to put a small sort of drying rack up if that's what you like. But most residents have those sort of little clothes horses that they move around to capture either the sun or the air conditioning. Heater blowing onto them.
And they are dangerous, actually.
They are, because you can trip over their feet.
Easily. Yes. And they collapse and they can get tangled up in those. So they're not particularly clever either.
No. So we do try and encourage the outside lines, or in our newer units, the lines are actually under a porch, so they're sheltered from the rain.
So they can use them all year round.
They can use them all year round.
Do you tend to use the wall-based dryers that sort of hang on the wall, or do you use the old rotaries still?
We have a mixture.
I do? Okay. I didn't know whether there was a preference for one or the other.
Some villages provide dryers and washing machines as part of the standard.
No, I was thinking about the drying...
The rack.
The washing lines. Yes, the ones attached to the wall.
Yeah. They're the go, are they?
Yes, they are, because then you can put the concrete pads underneath a clear footpath up to them, so it's quite clear where you stand to hang, and it's all very safe. It's
probably takes up less room.
It does.
Rotary.
The rotary ones, it's you need a very big concrete pad to be able to cover the whole rotary area.
So we're inside. We've heated the place. We are now comfortable. Have the kitchens changed?
Kitchens have changed over the years. Now we use wall ovens.
Right.
Because we find with older people, the blood pressure is a known issue in the elderly.
Yep.
And if you're bending over to get into the oven, any time you bend over, there's a chance that you can stand up too quickly and get a bit lightheaded. So particularly in the kitchen, we make sure that anything that's slightly dangerous is at that waist height, so you can open the door of the oven and put something in and out without having to bend over. We have overhead cupboards now as well as underneath ones.
Do you have more drawers than cupboards?
More drawers than cupboards is something that's only the last few years people request that, and now it's pretty much standard that wherever we can put a drawer rather than a cupboard, we will.
Because you can get that access to the rear space and actually use more of the space, can't you?
And it's much easier for people to reach into a drawer than it is to bend down to get to a back of a cupboard.
Mm. And those pull-out pantries, are they the go these days?
No, we've looked at those at the village, but we have found the maintenance on those, not quite at the standard where it's...
They can also be quite heavy, Brody.
No, I get that.
Yeah, they can actually be quite heavy to pull out a full pantry.
I just
know a friend who's got one. I'm always like, oh, I don't need to go to the gym today. I can just pull out their pantry door. But what about cooktops? I would imagine you...
Cooktops, our preference is electric cooktops. There are some people that still like the gas. They like the flame. But in terms of safety, it's the... Electric cooktops are much safer in that they're not going to set the paper towel you forgot to leave, put away safely on fire.
But imagine, you may even go down the track of induction further along.
Yes, we've looked at that.
It does take a bit of science to work that out. I know I've got one.
It does.
The induction.
Yes.
Yes, you do need your fancy pots and pans, don't you?
My mother-in-law's village has induction cooktops.
And
a whole new set of pans.
Yes, because I thought, again, you can, if you've left an electric... hob on, you can still burn yourself, whereas with the induction, nothing will have the heat except if you put the right pan on, so to speak.
The other thing that, regardless of whether it's gas or electric, villages have, and community homes do, you have the ability to actually switch things off right at the back of the switch, so that people who have memory problems and forget and leave the stove on, we can actually disable their stove so they can't turn it on. And that lets someone that can still, that has dementia but at a very low level.
Not going to that place for a cup of tea.
Stay home a lot longer than what they could have, which is something good about villages.
Right, because they can't accidentally...
Yeah, they can't accidentally leave the stove on because it's actually permanently switched off.
That was an issue with my dear mother-in-law. That brings us up to the end of this segment.
Well, thank you, Kim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was very informative.
I really don't know why we need the boys at
all. No. We might have to let them know.
Yes. Well, it's been lovely to be back.
Thank you, Kim.
And we'll look forward to seeing you again, if not when we come down to do the outside broadcast from you, which is towards the end of March.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Now, thanks, I picked the music for today.
You have, Brody, so it's all a surprise to me.
It's a complete surprise to me, too, I do have to say. But this one, I think that you might know who this is.
Oh, okay.
Do you know?
No Milk Today.
Yay.
I know the song.
And that was No Milk Today, which is probably often happens in this studio. We get No Milk Today. And welcome back to the Age Stage. Brody Guzet here. I don't have Vicky here with me anymore, just at this moment in time, because we had a malfunction yesterday on our recording with Brendan Hoban. So he very kindly agreed to come back into the studio. So this is a sort of stick it together, it's a glue and fix job. But nonetheless, we had so much that we talked about yesterday that was so interesting that we did manage to persuade him to get it back. So, Brendan, welcome back to the station. How are you?
Hello, Brody.
Well, it's, of course, not new to you, is it? Because you had something to do with this place.
Yes, we designed the radio station into the old Mornington High School. It was a very interesting project, dealing with a lot of acoustical issues, both spatial acoustic and room-to-room noise transmissions.
Mm.
I believe you've got a bit of a problem with the air conditioning,
but I
was not responsible for that.
I'm afraid it's a nightmare. It's an absolute shocking nightmare, but that's all right. The council, we hope, is getting onto that particular issue, because actually it's becoming quite serious, because there's so much of it that's broken down, and because, as you're aware, they're sealed units, and when they're sealed units and you can't control the temperature, and you get into some fairly serious, and in our production room, which is even more important, if that overheats, then our equipment just melts.
And, yes, not a good situation.
No, it's not. Anyway, it will be fixed. But today's topic is that we are looking at making your home age safe. Now, to me, that falls into a range of categories, either building for, and we've already heard today the building practices for people that design villages and the like, but then only a very small percentage of us actually come from villages, and those that do are fine, but those that don't are living in their houses forever need to get the house into a stage where it becomes age-friendly. What do you think of it? How does that work?
It does work, and there are lots of things that you can do to retrofit an existing house to make it more accessible. And there are a lot of design principles that you can put into the design of new homes. I should say that to retrofit costs approximately 20 times the cost of building it in the first place. But there are some low-hanging fruit that you can obtain that will make the house more accessible. Imagine, if you will, grandmas these days often are looking after grandchildren. They're a child minding service. And grandma comes to the front door with a babe in arms, possibly asleep, and with a toddler who's a bit fractious around her ankles. And she's got a handbag and two bags of shopping, and she's fumbling for a key. A simple fix is a shelf or a small table or other piece of furniture or even a chair at the front door.
That's genius.
Where you can put things down, find the key, open the door and resolve the situation that you're in.
Perfect.
It makes the house more accessible and it costs very little.
Nothing. Well, virtually nothing. Mm. So just a little table or a little ingle nook that you can just, or even if it was a fold-down table, it didn't have to be there all the time if you don't want it. Very clever. Like that idea. And that's your sort of low-hanging fruit approach, is it?
Yes, there are lots of others that cost very little but do have substantial improvements in making your house more accessible.
Now, a lot of houses, of course, have got steps, haven't they? And steps is primary issue.
Steps is always an issue, but you must realise that not all disabled people are in a wheelchair. I'm disabled, I wear glasses, and my hearing is poor.
Sorry?
I wear glasses, and my hearing is poor. Ambulant disabled people can accommodate steps, but you can make the steps more accessible by putting a handrail on both sides, not just one side.
Mm-hmm.
Steps that are easy, that is, have a low rise and a long going, are much easier to climb than steps that are steep. But in a house that has a wooden floor that's built up above the land, or indeed in a lot of the new houses on the peninsula where we have flooding problems and council require you to build at a height above ground level, that you've got to put in steps, there is no way to easily make the house accessible to a wheelchair.
Mm. Yes. No, I can fully gather that. I'm just wondering whether there's sort of wonderful technology where you could sort of go up to a point and turn on a tap or something and you get lifted up hydraulically and then go, it would be nice.
There are all sorts of those technologies, but a normal stair rider is about $30,000. A step ramp, that is a device that lifts you up four or five steps, is around about $50,000.
Wow.
And it's very expensive and it's not in the low-hanging fruit category.
No, absolutely, it's not.
But for those who have got failing sight, for example, simply changing over your light fittings inside your house to a much brighter fitting and at the same time go to an LED is going to save you in the heat generated, in the cost of running the lamp, in the cost of replacement of the lamp, because they'll last 50,000 hours or about a lifetime, and it improves the lighting level at the table that you're sitting at or the kitchen that you're working at. It makes a huge difference without costing a lot.
And there's also skirting lighting now, isn't there, so that you
there
can
is.
Mark doors and things that you can fall in, you know, crash into and things.
There are even paints that are fluorescent.
Oh, really?
That you can put on the edge of steps and on your skirting boards in areas where it is possible that you might fall.
Mm.
And this will give you a level of very low level of lighting all through the night if the lighting level during the day has been fairly good.
It's a clever idea too. If I was a young person now, and I've just got my home, let's assume I'm sort of 40-ish or whatever, children are teen, getting up to teen, I'm going to be there for a while. Should I actually keep those ideas in my mind for my next renovation, even though it's not going to be specifically for an aged person, but it could be? Is that, does it add to its value?
It does, but the, there are many categories where accessible housing is useful. It's families with very young children, people who sustain a temporary injury, aging baby boomers, which is, the I guess, your target market, and people with disability and other impairments and their families. Everyone benefits from a house that is accessible. It's easy to build all of these things into a new home. It's much more difficult to retrofit it to an existing home. And just an example of the 20 times cost is that, let's say, you go through your front door and you're faced with a passageway which is 900 millimetres or 90 centimetres or 3 feet wide, and the code says that it ought to be 1100 millimetres or 110 centimetres, a metre 0.1, or around about 4 foot 4 inches wide. It's enormously expensive to pull that wall down, to move it, to rebuild a new wall, to repair the ceiling, repair the floor, repaint, and then do all the floor coverings again.
I suppose there's an argument for having grid-built houses so that you can plug and move. But that's a long way away. Well, I suppose it's not.
It's not. In in retirement villages, in hotels, motels, and other areas where legislation requires us to provide accessibility, we already do that. From day one.
Now, you had a you referred to a booklet yesterday, or something that we could access on the internet, which would be hugely of benefit.
Yes, it's called Livable Housing Design. It's a an initiative by a state government in Victoria, and all you need to do is Google Living Housing Design, and it will provide it to you. The guideline is 64 pages, but don't let that put you off. It's very, very simple to read, and it's broken down into chapters that deal with individual rooms, and it gives standards that you can achieve. A silver standard, which is the fairly good, a gold standard, which is better, and a platinum standard, which is the best.
Right.
And it'll provide you with guidelines that will guide you in the design of a new home, and will also tell you what you can do to your existing home.
Now, just to cover off one last point, because this has been a matter of debate, is reverse cycle air conditioning the most economical form of heating and cooling?
There are several answers to that question.
Oh, dear.
In terms of electricity, it's highly efficient.
Yes.
The heat output, the cooling output is highly efficient, and it does a wonderful job. If we're talking the air conditioner that we have in a normal house, which is up on the wall, called a fascia unit, with a split condenser outside, all that is doing is recycling the air within the room and conditioning it. Conditioning it by either cooling or heating it and removing the moisture from it, that moisture you'll see dripping outside. It doesn't introduce fresh air.
Right.
In commercial buildings, we can't use them.
Right.
We have to use systems that are ducted, such as you have here in the studio, which introduce fresh air from the outside, because this room is entirely enclosed and it has no openable windows.
Oh, well, there you go. I think I just lost my bet. Brendan, so thank you so much for coming in today. It's been terrific. We'd love to talk to you again as we progress through the age stage, and now that we've formed the relationship, give some thought to that about talking about, because you may want to say, look, I want to come on the show. I've just found some new gadgets or things that I think are terrific that you could have in your home, and that would be a great advantage for us in the future.
Give me a call. Our office is just 5 minutes away.
And you are with Hoban Haynes Building Designers.
Yes, yes.
We've, in Mornington.
Been in Mornington for 44 years.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming in today. Greatly appreciate it. You're welcome.
Welcome back to The Age Stage, and with us now we have Dr. Shulman. Can we call you Mark, Dr. Shulman?
Absolutely.
Great. Now, Mark, you're at the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre, and you're...
I'm at the Alfred Hospital.
Alfred. Apologies. At the Alfred. And you're conducting a trial currently on predicting post-surgical outcomes, and in particular looking for how those outcomes can impact quality of life. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So we're conducting research specifically in older patients, so patients over the age of 70.
Right.
Looking at what things that might predict them having poor recovery or increased disability, or another way of saying that is a poor quality of life after surgery.
Right, so that it would be a different level of or quality of life than what they have prior to that surgery. That's the baseline you're trying to establish?
That's right.
Can you give us an example of what such a condition might be?
Absolutely. I guess an obvious example that springs to mind is if somebody has surgery and they might suffer a stroke as a consequence of that surgery, that may lead to some severe physical and perhaps emotional limitations that stop them being able to do the things they might have been able to do in the past.
But how would you, other than say, well, you're 76 years of age, you've got a heart condition, you've been taking your tablets fairly irregularly, other than that, how else could you put a marker on the likelihood?
Well, that's what we're attempting to determine.
Right.
These sorts of studies trying to predict risk have been done before, but previous studies have looked at predicting specific problems such as stroke, heart attack, problems with kidneys, that sort of thing. But the problem with those studies is, a heart attack can be a very variable thing, can be quite mild, and perhaps you might not have any permanent consequences from it, right through to being quite disabling. So instead of trying to predict specific complications or problems with surgery, we're trying to predict having increased disability after surgery. So it doesn't matter so much matter what the complication is, but just that they'll have a poorer quality of life or increased disability after surgery. And we're looking at a range of things, from the sorts of things that you were describing. They might have a pre-existing medical condition or pre-existing problems with their function, through to different kinds of operations or even perhaps things that might happen after surgery, and looking at different things that might help us to predict people who are going to develop disability afterwards.
And so it's educating them prior to their surgery as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess one of the main aims is if we can predict those people who might have problems, it'll enable discussions between the patient's doctor and the patient and their family to talk about whether that surgery may or may not be appropriate for them, or perhaps they need to consider alternative treatments for the condition they might have.
Right.
But it also helps the anaesthetist and surgeons and other doctors in the hospital plan the level of care they might need when they go to hospital. For example, they might need some interventions to improve their health before they have surgery, or they might need an increased level of care, for example, intensive care after surgery.
Right.
So there are other things we can do to modify risk, depending on what we think their risk might be.
So it's also to assist that whole journey being a little bit more well-planned, for want of a better term. Is that what you're saying?
That's a perfect term. It's exactly right. We call it the perioperative journey, and planning that and being able to discuss it is very important.
If I can be a bit tough at this stage, I've always found that whenever you go into a hospital and you're going to have surgery, or you know someone who is, and you're sitting there having the conversation, and you say, well, okay, tell me, you know, what's happening and what you're going to do, what the options are of you that are available to me. Mm-hmm. And then the doctor says, now it's up to you. Do you think this might change though eventually, to where a doctor will have more courage to be able to say, well, you know what, on a percentage of ABC, looking at your markers, I would probably be thinking, well, you know, do you really want to go through all this?
That's an excellent question. It's slightly off the topic of this research, but having said that, it's something that I'm interested in, and I definitely agree with you that for a number of reasons, medical practice has changed over the years, and doctors are a little bit more reluctant to give advice, especially when there are really difficult decisions to make. They often defer the decision back to the patient. And I think, certainly when there's more information, and so doctors can be more confident with providing that advice. For example, if they had a risk score such as the one we're proposing, and they could give the patient a real statistic, like you've got a 1 in 3 chance of having significant disability after this surgery, according to this score, then that would help them give advice to provide a decision rather than to defer it back to the patient.
Because clearly one of the great problem markers in that instance are things like cancer, which is going to involve surgery. It's going to involve, or probably, and let's say it does, and it may involve post-operative activity like radiation or whatever else it might be. So it's, and you may not survive. So, you know, that's something that people are faced with every single day, and I'm believing that potentially out of the work that you're doing, that they will be in a much better position to lay all the cards out on the table visually and say, this is what it looks like. And from that, between us as adults, we can infer A, B and C and look at a decision combined. Is that...
Look, that's hopefully... I mean, we can never fully predict exactly what's going to happen to someone. And there are a lot of variables in the sort of scenario you're describing, which might involve chemotherapy, radiotherapy. But look, at least it'll be an important part of the puzzle where we can say, look, you know, for example, look, if you have this surgery, you have a very high risk of becoming permanent, well, having long-term disability or increased disability or poor level of function afterwards, to which someone, you know, there might be a kind of person who says, look, that's fine, as long as I survive, I don't mind if that's the case. And another person might say, look, I wouldn't be prepared to live with that, and that might help them to make their decision.
So again, it's more about having the education or the information of what the possible outcome could be. And as you've said, you can't define what that outcome is or predict what that outcome is. It's just that you're trying to impart as much knowledge as you can to the actual the patient themselves and their family.
That's right. That's exactly right. We're never going to have a risk prediction tool that's 100% accurate or tells the whole story, but we hope that this will be accurate and give an important information. And it's also, I'd like to stress, information that should be readily understandable and important to the patient.
Yes, of course.
Some statistics can be a little bit difficult and vague for patients and not necessarily directly applicable to their lives.
Right.
I was having a this discussion about this interview with some friends of mine and before the show, and there was one of them who's a complete cynic, but raised a very interesting point, and that was, if you get your markers and if you get this right as the years go on or whatever, so that it is a much higher level of predictive correctness, that potentially the insurance people might say, is this going to be more expensive? Are you going to be more expensive to look after afterwards or not? And if it turns out that you are going to be more expensive afterwards, for whatever the reasons, they say, well, you'll have to pay for that out of your own pocket. Now, I know it's very extreme, but it's one of the interesting dichotomies of having that level of corrective intelligence, because then it becomes fact. And you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Look, I can't... I'm not an expert on how insurance...
No. That's what I say. He was a cynic.
...determine their premiums, yes, and so on, and I understand the cynical comment and where that's coming from. I guess I would say, though, insurance companies already have very high or large amounts of actuarial data about, yes, patients' conditions and the things that predict risk and predict likely poor outcome. Fortunately, in Australia, to my knowledge, they don't refuse treatment based on your risk at this stage.
Mm. Right.
Now, I know there's precedent for that in America, but that doesn't happen, to my knowledge, in Australia.
How long will your program, your testing research, go on for?
Look, at the moment, it's planned to go for 3 years,
mm-hmm,
but the database and registry system that we've set up at the Alfred will continue for longer than that, as part of a way that we can, sort of a quality assurance measure, so we can continue monitoring people's outcomes after surgery and make sure that, you know, there's a good level of quality assurance that goes on.
Will that be an opt-in opportunity for a patient? So they'll be said, would you like to be part of this program? Or
no, look, we've actually done it the other way around and made it an opt-out. So
we will
include all patients over the age of 70 in this. The reason we're doing it that way is that we want to include patients who are having elective or planned surgery, but also include patients who are having emergency surgery.
Mm.
And it's not really possible to include those to give those patients a proper informed consent prior to the procedure. So what we'll do instead is give them information. There's information on a website. There's information that we'll post to them, and we'll speak to them as well after the surgery. And at that stage, they'll decide whether they want to stay in or in fact have their data removed.
Generally speaking, this is a question that's sort of from me more than anything else. At what age should I be much more aware of anaesthetic being a problem, generally speaking?
There are a couple of components to that question. One is, and the question assumes that it's the anaesthetic that's the risk.
Yes.
So I'll deal with the first one. At what age? We know we don't know, but from the initial previous research we've done, we know that people over the age of 70 are more likely to have post-operative disability that can be long-term, up to 6 to 12 months afterwards. We haven't measured beyond that. But we didn't have enough people in that study to really be able to give an exact age. But and it really, the other thing about age is, while age is important, the person's chronological age isn't necessarily as important as their general fitness and health. So you can have a very unhealthy 70-year-old, and you can have a very fit 70-year-old who can run a marathon, and they'll certainly have different risk. So age in itself isn't necessarily, exact age isn't necessarily completely predictive. The other thing about your question is, we don't really know whether it's the anaesthetic or the surgery itself that carries the most risk. It's very difficult to tease that out. And it's probably a combination of the both and the body's reaction to the stress of having, you know, a major operation afterwards. Because most complications that happen do happen in the days to weeks after surgery rather than actually during the operation.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating, isn't it?
Yes, thank you very much.
And maybe, if we may, could we contact you perhaps in sort of 6 months' time or something and see how it's going?
Yeah, of course. No problem at all.
That'd be wonderful. Thank you so much for your time. The Age Stage is much the richer for your wonderful contribution.
You're very welcome, and thanks for inviting me to be on the show.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, there you go.
Another show down, Brody.
Well, yeah, it's getting close to that. I found that really, really interesting. In fact, the whole show has been interesting.
Oh, it has been. Yeah. It's been very enlightening today.
It has. And Kim was an absolute
a font.
Star. Well, she was, but she, you know, she knows her information level is
extremely
so great.
High.
And on yes. so many facets of village life, but also on many other things, because she's, yes. as you say, she's a nurse.
She's a nurse as well, so she gets it from a number of different angles, doesn't she?
Yep. Well, I can only hope that we manage to get... I hope that voice, that Brendan brought the voice, because he did say that he had a croaky voice, so I hope
that comes through.
I hope that it comes through, but we can only hope, pray, yeah. really.
And we'll see you next week.
Yeah, we will. If you got anything special this week?
No, I don't think so. Just another day in paradise.
So we will catch up with you in
a week's time.
In a week's time. Well, you take care of yourself.
You
too. Try and keep warm if it's cold.
And cool if it's warm.
Okay, well, yeah. I think it's supposed to be... Well, it's going to be sort of wet for most of the week.
Oh.
I've got to do the lawns.
Oh, you can come and do mine.
Take care.
Bye,
see you
Brody.
Soon. Bye.